You're listening to an episode of NARCAD's core podcast series. For more information on academic detailing, visit us at narcad.org and stick around after this episode. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the most recent episode of our NARCAD podcast. At NARCAD, we're the National Resource Center for Academic Detailing, so we talk about all things related to clinical outreach education. And this is Bevan Shigori, your host today. I'm the Communications Director here at NARCAD. I'm excited to say that our special guest today is Rebecca. Rebecca Edelberg works over at Alosa Health, which is our sister agency, also founded by Dr. Jerry Avorn, who is the chief of the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and Pharmacoeconomics at Brigham and Women's Hospital under the Department of Medicine. Rebecca is the program director over at Alosa Health, and she's going to talk to us today about managing programs in the field where clinical outreach educators are going into practices and talking one-to-one with clinicians about behavior changes that can really provide better outcomes for patients on a variety of clinical topics. Hi, Rebecca. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Bevan. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. I'm really excited to be here today, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
So, Rebecca, tell us a little bit about Alosa Health in general. Tell us a little bit about what a typical day looks like, the different sorts of projects that the organization focuses on, and then we can kind of drill down to program management.
Sure. So, as you know, we are a Boston-based organization. We're a nonprofit, and our primary focus is twofold. Part one of what we do is develop clinical education materials. So we have a number of physician researchers on staff with us who comb through relevant medical literature on a variety of topics. And then after having identified and culled forth the most relevant and recent evidence from the medical literature that exists on a given topic, they then package that into an easily digestible format. We have a graphic designer on staff who helps us. And the idea is that we present this information in a way that's easily understandable to a busy clinician who doesn't have the time to read through hours and hours worth of medical literature. And we want to present that in a way that's also aesthetically appealing.
Rebecca, that's so fascinating because, you know, here at NARCAD, we were just on the road doing a training about the opioid epidemic. And we were, you know, sharing a statistic that is actually 25 years old, but is still fascinating, even if you applied it to now, which is back in 1992, there was a statistic about the fact that to keep up with relevant clinical literature, a general internist would have to read 17 new articles every single day of the year, including weekends and holidays. And that was 25 years ago. So if you even doubled or tripled that, which it's actually probably much more than that at this stage, you know, one can see why we really need in clinical outreach education dynamic and interactive visual aids to really help facilitate those conversations. So that's a really awesome part of what you all do. Can you talk to us about the other piece that you were mentioning?
Sure, absolutely. So the second piece of what we do is actually bringing that information out into the field. And that is the programmatic side of things. That's primarily where I work. So the first thing that we need to do is, I should back up and say that our work is typically executed through partnership with either a local, regional, or state government. And typically, it's our partner who will identify a clinical area of concern in their region. So let's say, for example, we have one of our many programs going on right now is a program that's focused on PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. And that's a preventive medication that can be given to patients who are at high risk for contracting HIV. So once this topic was identified for us, and simultaneously, while all of the clinical content is being developed, we have to think logistically and operationally, how are we going to push this information out and get it into the hands or get it into the minds of the practicing clinicians on the ground and who are located in disparate geographies from where we are in Boston? So one of the challenges that we're finding with PrEP specifically is that because it's it's a preventive topic, but it has to do with HIV. Our primary targets for this information are all internal medicine physicians, because again, this is a topic that's very heavily prevention focused. But we're finding that many of our physicians are not even aware that this is something that falls within the scope of their practice, because they always have associated HIV with being an issue that falls under the purview of infectious disease.
That's true, and we've found that prevention for HIV is really becoming part of primary care. So that's really interesting. What other pushback are people in the programs that you're working on, receiving, and what kinds of pushback in general would you say comes up across clinical topics?
So across topics, one of the challenges that we encounter fairly often is that people, or physicians, I should say, are not accustomed to having someone come visit them in their office purely for the purpose of bringing them medical information. So sometimes when we go in, there's confusion about who we are. We often get questions about where this information is coming from, if anyone is sponsoring it. And frequently we're mistaken, or I should say our clinical educators in the field are mistaken for pharmaceutical reps. Mm-hmm. So naturally, the methodology that we employ is quite similar to that. We are going out into the field. We are engaging with clinicians one-on-one. But a key element, a vital component actually of what we do, and something that we're very proud of, is that all of the information that we're bringing is evidence-based, non-commercial, and we receive no sponsorship from the pharmaceutical industry. So that is a barrier that we have to overcome right off the bat, in addition to, the typical barriers that you might expect of lack of time. Many times clinicians will say to us, well, I understand the information that you're bringing me in theory, and this all sounds very well and good, but implementing key messages is a big challenge. And part of the work that our educators do is helping clinicians not just to understand cerebrally the topic, but also helping them to understand how to execute on that in a practical clinical setting.
So you're talking about taking something from theoretical content or research into actual usable, an actually usable format that can be woven into their day-to-day practice. Is that right?
Exactly. Because really what we're trying to do is influence and shape the way that clinicians are practicing. We don't want this to just be another source of information that they file away and that they're never able to actually use with their patients to improve patient care.
What I want to do is take a step back from the front lines and talk about how you, as a program manager or a program director now, actually support these different groups that are in the field who are doing that hands-on education. And how do you, from a remote perspective, really maintain strong relationships with those folks in the field and support them in doing their work?
Of course, one of the most important things is that we need to make sure that we're hiring the right people. And all of our clinical educators have clinical backgrounds, either in nursing or as pharmacists. So right off the bat, these folks are very, very knowledgeable. But part two is that you really need to be someone who is tenacious, I'll say, someone who feels comfortable walking into a medical office, being a little bit extroverted, being persistent in getting to the point where you actually can access a physician. Some of the role has to do with your training and your clinical knowledge, but a big part of the role also has to do with, the characteristics that you bring to the table as a person. And so our success really depends first and foremost on getting the right people into these roles.
We've found that other programs think the same thing. And a lot of times we get the question of, does it have to be clinician to clinician? Does it have to be an MD to an MD? And we've also seen a lot of success rates with folks who have backgrounds in public health. And then we also know that certain departments of public health who have been doing this kind of work for a while have said that clinical content is teachable, but that tenacity that you mentioned and that interpersonal intelligence is really something that you've kind of got it or you don't. What other tips would you share for folks who are in program management roles, either longstanding or new program managers who are trying to wrap their heads around all of this? What are kind of some of the key takeaways that you think would be ideal for a strong program manager to really understand and to be thinking about?
There are two things that come to mind immediately. And the first is, from the start, having very regular contact and communication with your field detailers, especially for academic detailing programs where there may be only one or two detailers. I think it's very easy for them to feel isolated or to kind of feel as though they're lacking direction. So especially at the beginning, I would say that you want to have at least weekly check-ins with that individual. And it gives you an opportunity to convey any information that's important for them to be aware of, but it also gives them an opportunity to ask you any questions and to share successes or challenges that they're having in a way that doesn't require them to be proactive in picking up the phone, because it's time that's already built in.
I really like that idea of a sort of regular weekly touch point, and I think, you know, as with managing any important project that involves human beings, and especially when you're talking about hiring folks who are, you know, potentially more on the extroverted side and they're going out and they're talking to people, but then maybe they're traveling across a certain jurisdiction or geography alone, and they may want to bounce ideas off of somebody. And I think a lot of the folks who are part of our network, who really tune into our podcasts and our blog to figure out how to make all of this work, do also struggle with having teams of detailers that are very small. And so there aren't you know, necessarily in-person group meetings very often where people can connect and share the challenges that they're facing. And so I really like the idea of a program manager really being the conduit there, and by having weekly check-ins, just creating a regular space to feedback versus just waiting for a detailer to call when there's a problem. So that's a great tip.
And the second piece that I would want to emphasize to anyone who's in a role where they're managing academic detailing programs is reporting. So more than likely, you're accountable to someone, regardless of who that is, and you'll be generating reports in some capacity on your academic detailing activities in the field. So I found that it's much easier to generate these reports and to make sure that you have good data to put into your reports if you're thinking about this from the start and you're thinking about A, what type of data do I want to collect, and B, how am I going to collect that data? So of course, you know, you're interested in things like how many visits am I doing, but then there are some, you know, things can become a little bit more variable. You may want to measure program impact. Are you going to do that by simply asking the participants in the program about their satisfaction with the program? There are lots of ways to do that. And there's no one right or wrong way, but it's something that you want to be thinking about. It's a lot easier to think about this stuff strategically at the outset of your program than trying to piece all of these sections together and kind of scramble for this data on the back end, and it will make your life a lot easier. When you're thinking about these reports, I would say it's perfectly fine to ask those entities to whom you report what kind of information they're interested in seeing, because you can't report on data if you don't have it, and in many cases, you won't have data unless you ask for it. So just being very mindful about all of this from the start is a strong recommendation on my end.
That's a great point, Rebecca. And I think in terms of, again, always thinking about the new folks who are just getting into this and kind of trying to tread water with all the great info that's coming at them, you know, we'd love to, you know, recommend different tools for them as they're, so they don't have to, you know, recreate the wheel. I know there's a lot of great stuff up on our website, and would love to, as we're getting ready to close up here for the podcast, you know, ask you if you'd be willing, if people who listen to the podcast have specific questions for you to pick from your expertise, can we have them email us at narcat@partners.org and send that over to you for some tips and tricks?
Absolutely, 100%.
We'd love to have you back for more program management tools, and just to kind of talk about some more of the great work you're doing at ELOSA. So we hope we can connect with you a little bit later in the year.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of NARCAD's Core podcast series. We encourage you to join us for future podcasts. Visit us to see which episodes have aired at narcad.org. We also encourage you to visit our Learning Center, as well as our Best Practices blog and our conference and training series pages. If you have any questions about academic detailing, including a desire to reach out and partner with us, we're happy to help. Contact us at narcad@partners.org.